call the case of Manning versus State 74982. Ms. Holliday.
May it please the court, Justice Stiglitz, Justice Hardesty, and Justice Silver. I'm Christy Holliday from the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Appellant Juan Manning. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to start with a quote from the state in the record. It wasn't until we just heard the clerk read the information that we realized the language is wrong. That's volume 2 at 436. As Mr. Manning walked into trial that day, and as the jury was sworn in, he could not lose. It was an easy not guilty. There was no scenario in which the state could have proven what the information said that he did. But once the state amended the information to include ambiguous, convoluted, and confusing theories that Mr. Manning had not been prepared to defend against, it changed everything in the trial, including the defense for Mr. Manning. Now, Mr. Manning has a substantial right under the Sixth Amendment, due process, and the Nevada Constitution to notification of the theory of prosecution. The amending of the information moments before opening statements and just after the jury had been sworn in prejudiced his right to notification of the theory of prosecution. And so we're asking that the court reverse this conviction.
I have a question, and I'll ask the state as well, with what went on in the record, because I'm unclear when I went into the record. On the issue on vindictive prosecution, the underlying motion in front of Judge Leavitt was that this defendant, Manning, was offered a misdemeanor in 90 days. And then I read the transcript of what transpired at that particular hearing. That was not relayed again. But then there's another document within the record showing another defendant with Mr., I think it's Cochever, getting a misdemeanor in 90 days. My question is, I was unclear which was correct. Was, in fact, Mr. Manning offered by a deputy 90 days misdemeanor, and then Mr. Giacomo came in and pulled that? Because that's what you alleged in that. Can you clarify that?
Sure.
And where would it be in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. So, I have a bunch of sticky notes here to signify where everything is in the record, but I can clarify the timeline for you. So, Mr. Manning was alleged to have committed the offense that we're here on today, my case, first. That was after the specific prosecutor in this case had lost an issue where he had been convicted of a prior case. So then he picks up my case. Then, as he's
in your case is the late bet case.
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
Then Mr. Manning bailed out on this case.
Right.
And unfortunately, he picked up another case where he was also accused of adding money to his wager. And that's when a different prosecutor dealt that case to a misdemeanor with, I think it was 90 days.
To this defendant?
Yes, same
defendant. On a late bet?
On a late bet.
Can you give us the site when you sit down? Would you, not right now,
okay.
On your rebuttal, would you give us where in the record that is that he was given the misdemeanor 90 days for the same offense?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
And so I think that along with the other facts of what happened with the specific prosecutor in this case create a showing or at least an appearance of vindictive prosecution, which then would have required the district court to hold a hearing to look further into the facts of what happened and would have required the state then to come forward with facts demonstrating why this was not vindictive prosecution. So just to review, again, the specific prosecutor in this case had another case with Mr. Manning in which he was convicted, he was sentenced under the small habitual, and eventually he won a habeas petition and he was released from custody. When he picked up this case, Mr. Giacomo was not on our track where this case originated.
This is Judge Sullivan? Whose track is it?
This used to be Judge Marshall at the time. And Judge Marshall tracked up to Judge Kephart and Judge Leavitt. And I believe Mr. Giacomo was handling the outers at that time. She wasn't on the track, but she pulled somehow the case. And of course, I wanted information about how exactly that happened. And that would have been great information to go over in a hearing about how exactly she came to have this case. But she requested the case or pulled the case somehow. And she requested the large habitual, and she decided she would make no offer on the case. And I think individually, those things might not create an appearance of impropriety. I mean, I'm not arguing that Mr. Manning is entitled to a negotiation. I certainly wouldn't argue that. But it's unusual enough for a deputy to pick up a case that she, you know, she's not assigned. It's unusual enough for someone not to be made an offer. And then it's unusual that under the same facts of a different case, the defendant gets a misdemeanor in 90 days, that it creates an appearance of vindictive prosecution that I think the district court should have explored further through a hearing. I think we would have found out a lot more about how the specific prosecutor was able to get this case and why.
Why wasn't there a hearing?
Well, I think the district court judge didn't feel that there was enough of an appearance.
Well, motion was made, correct?
That's correct.
I thought you guys get hearings on every motion that's made.
I wish that were true, Your Honor. Unfortunately, it's not. Okay. We did have a hearing. I mean, we were able to argue the motion in front of the mm-hmm. district court judge, but I would have loved a hearing where we would have had evidence and we would have had testimony, again, about maybe how Mr. Giacomo came to pick up this case. Did she make statements to maybe the team chief about why she wanted to pick this particular case? Maybe we could.
Isn't there enough of a prima facie showing by the defense by saying that she lost on one case and he got released pending appeal, and then suddenly there's the pickup from an outlying rural deputy who now picks up a Las Vegas Justice Court case, the same defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that creates a perfect scenario of an appearance.
So why wasn't there a hearing then on that, an evidentiary hearing?
Again, when we discussed the motion in district court with the district court judge didn't think that there was enough of an appearance. At first, the district court judge thought that maybe this particular prosecutor was still on the rogue team, and the rogue team used to do stuff like this. When we explained that she was not on the rogue team, I think the district court judge responded by saying, well, people aren't entitled to negotiations, and he has a bad record, doesn't he? So that's why the district court judge didn't take it farther and have a hearing with, you know, witnesses and evidence.
But the district court, and I did read that transcript, also noted that there was no rogue team and that she was not on the rogue team.
That's correct, Your Honor.
She was on the outlying area track.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. And what I think stands out the most and is the most important is, even if we assume in arguendo that Mr. Manning's record, along with a new felony offense, warranted habitual criminal sentence, there's no reason why there would have to be a specific prosecutor who could make that happen. I mean, why would it not be appropriate for any prosecutor on the team where the case originated to look at the record, look at the new offense, and seek the habitual criminal punishment with no offer? If it was that clear, I think any prosecutor could have done that. I don't see a reason why a particular prosecutor would have needed to handle that if it were not because of the prior history.
So, Ms. Holliday, I want to turn your attention, because I'm mindful of your time, of the fact that Mr. Manning meets the statutory requirements for the large habitual. Why was an abuse of discretion by the judge to sentence him to that?
I don't think just because a judge can sentence someone to the large habitual that it's appropriate in every situation. In this situation, the offense is not violent, and the offense, whether it's a felony or not in the state of Nevada to cheat at gambling, the offense has to do with an extra $5. In many other scenarios, this would be a petty larceny kind of charge for someone to be trying to, you know, gain an additional $5 through illegal means. In addition to that, Mr. Manning's record was not violent. In all those prior felonies and all those prior years, he had one robbery conviction, and we had because it was so old, we had a really hard time finding the specific facts of that conviction, but all the other convictions were petty thefts. I mean, the prior offense that he got the small habitual on that was later overturned, he was accused of stealing diapers and dog food from Walmart, and his entire record is filled with offenses like that. And I think it shocks the conscience that someone would get a life sentence for this felony and that record. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay.
May it please the court, Justice Stiglitz, Justice Silver, and Justice Hardesty. My name is Sandra DiGiacomo. I'm the Chief Deputy District Attorney with the DA's office. I am one of the trial attorneys. Rachel O'Halloran, who is also present, was the other trial attorney. And I presume we should just go ahead and start with the vindictive prosecution.
Whatever you like.
Can you start also with that factual? I couldn't really tell what happened with that offer.
Sure.
Because it did sound like they made an accusation that he got 90 days, but then later in the record I saw something else.
Right. So, and I won't be able to cite to their record for you. I apologize. I didn't write down those numbers. So this is what happened. I prosecuted him for the case that they called diapers and dog food, which he went into a Walmart with a receipt, got the items, then returned them. So it was a burglary. He was a habitual or a rogue target at the time, and I believe it was in the 2009, I think, when I tried that case. Even though the rogue team got disbanded and I was moved, the deputies in our office are responsible for all of our post-conviction. So when it came back on post-conviction and needed a hearing, I was the one handling it. After that hearing, Judge Walsh did grant the petition, and then the state appealed it. She let him out of custody while it was on appeal. And while it was on appeal is when the defendant started picking up these other cases. Because a deputy who's got one of these set for prelim would run them, see what else is open, it came to their attention, I was actively still prosecuting him because even if I lost the appeal, it would come back, we would set it for trial, I would retry him again on that case. When it came to my attention, he had the first one that's the subject of this trial case, I told the deputy, yeah, I will do that with you because it is not uncommon in our office that you will prosecute your defendant with other prosecutors. So then...
It is uncommon for if you're in the rurals to just go switch tracks for one case.
Well, actually, it's not uncommon in our office if you're prosecuting a defendant and he picks up another case that you will also jump on or prosecute that case with the deputy assigned, which is what happened here. That, I mean, I know it's been years since you've been there, Justice Silver, but no, it's not uncommon. If somebody, you're prosecuting for murder, they get rearrested on something else, you'll handle that case. So, at the time, I was actively prosecuting him because I intended to retry him again when it came back from appeal. He picks up the new case. He picked up two or three more cases, some petty larcenies as well as another post-betting like this case. I don't think I found out about that case until after it happened. I spoke to Mr. Cochever about what happened. And he had left his case on for trial because he knew that there were the other two cases pending. Left it on for prelim. However, it's my understanding no witnesses appeared and he had to deal it. And so,
he dealt it to a misdemeanor 90
right,
days for the
right,
same conduct.
For the same conduct because he did not have his witnesses is my understanding.
I recognize that the question is maybe pushing it there. Is any of this in the record? Because I want to just distinguish what's in the record and what's not in the record.
This was all in our argument for
it was
for vindictive prosecution, and it was
just
in the
argument.
Meetings.
Okay.
Well,
so,
I think what she's talking about is, I didn't know, like you're adding him, well, there was no witnesses. It wasn't. I just need clarification on whether or not it was him or a different defendant. I just didn't want to be wrong on
no,
the facts.
It was Mr. Manning. Yes. And then he picked up two other misdemeanor petty larceny cases.
That wasn't in the record. So I'm only going with what was presented to Judge Leavitt.
Okay.
Which was that for the exact same crime, what I read in the exchange on that one issue on vindictiveness, was that he picked up the same charge, late bet, and that he got a misdemeanor in 90 days.
Right.
That is correct, then.
That is correct, okay. But it was also a case that we weren't going to be able to proceed on at preliminary hearing.
Okay, that part wasn't in the record. When I read it,
this
is all new to me, that
okay.
part.
Well, it was in our opposition to the motion for vindictive prosecution, and I talked about it in general terms, but there are reasons why cases similar get dealt differently, and I did put in there one of them could be we don't have our witnesses and can't proceed. But at the time, too, Your Honors, when this case went to prelim, and we filed the habitual notice, and it was going to go to trial. The appeal, is my recollection, had not come back yet. So I still believed I was going to be actively prosecuting him for my original case from 2009. It wasn't until the appeal was denied, and it went back to Judge Walsh, she would not let us try the case again and just dismissed it.
And I read in the record it was affirmed. That her granting the petition was affirmed.
No, it was affirmed, but then when it came back, which we would start all over and she'd be able to try the case,
right.
She dismissed it. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And at the time that this case was proceeding, I still thought I had another case I was going to go to trial on him as well. But it turned out we were precluded from that, and then this was the case we had. And with regard to the vindictive prosecution, know that they're claiming that because he exercised these rights that something got escalated, or it isn't true. What we did in this case, or what I argued for in this case, was the exact same thing I argued for in the prior case back in 2009-2010. I made the same argument. Back then I argued for a large habitual and 10 to life. I did not get that. He got the small habitual. And but for him committing and going out and committing more crimes, I would not have had, as you'd say, a second bite at the apple. He was still a rogue target when he got out on the other case and picked up new cases, and that didn't change. So I didn't seek him out. I didn't personally try and punish him. That's not what this is. This is somebody who the state felt should not be out in the community because he's not going to stop committing crimes. At the time, back in 2009, he had 13 prior felonies. That one, he got a small habitual and didn't learn his lesson. Just got out and committed more crimes.
Mr. Giacomo?
Yes?
I want to move to the sentencing issue.
Okay.
I think you've kind of iterated why you sought those, and certainly the statute permits you to.
Yes.
Rhetorically, I'd say I don't know that I agree with going forward on those, that level of charge for a $5 bet. That's your discretion. When it comes to the judge's determination to actually sentence someone for a $5 bet bump, then I have to determine, we have to determine as a panel, whether that judge abused their discretion. Because just because a judge can sentence to 10 to life on that doesn't necessarily mean they should. And that's subject to abuse of discretion.
Right.
So I want to know why it was not an abuse of discretion, given the character of the prior felonies, the age of the prior felonies, and the current offense, to give this gentleman 10 to life.
All right. Well, when you're talking about the age of the prior felonies, I think it's important to look at the continuous criminal conduct. Mm-hmm. I know the Sessions case talks about, you know, staleness, but in that case, you're talking about somebody who committed, you know, these felonies and then was...
I agree with you. I just want to save time because I see the time.
Okay.
13 felonies, and probably if he got out tomorrow, he's going to be picking up dog food or dropping another $5 bet.
Okay.
The question is, all those things being equal, we looked at the time, he was barely out of custody between offenses.
Right.
why does it not shock the conscience still to get 10 to life on this offense?
So I guess what I'm hearing is it could shock the conscience because in this case it was just a $5 bet. Mm-hmm. Or as Judge Togliatti had talked about in the prior, a bag of chiclets. With the habitual, you're not just being punished for the crime you're committing. You're also, it's going back and seeing the fact that you are a thief. You are not going to stop being a thief. And if you look at all of his priors, it's all the same thing. And it's to, at some point, it's to protect the community as well. Because, you know, when Judge Leavitt sentenced him, she had kind of she had the bonus of seeing what would happen when he got out of custody for being habitualized. You know, normally, judges, when you sit on the bench, you're trying to predict what's going to happen down the road when you're determining your sentence. She had the benefit of seeing what he got and how it didn't deter him and it didn't stop him. And it wasn't going to stop him. So I don't think it's an abuse of discretion when you're talking about somebody who's been committing crimes that we know of for, I think it was at the time, 37 or 38 years, non-stop. So it's not just you're punishing him for an extra $5 bet. It's his entire history. It's somebody who's not going to stop, and at some point you do have to protect the community. And when Judge Leavitt, this sentencing was not quick. I'm sure you can tell from the transcript. It was over an hour. She considered everything, and it was, you know, very thorough, and I don't think she abused her discretion, especially when you look at the O'Neill case, and when somebody's got all these priors, you start with the kind of presumption, okay, they are habitual, so why should I now strike them? There's no reason. He caught a huge benefit. He did when he got the other case reversed, and then we weren't allowed to try him on it. He got a small habitual, but he learned nothing. He just went on and kept committing more crimes. And but for the fact that he ended up back in custody, he would have committed probably more crimes.
Ms. Jackman, what about the fact you did have a prior case with him and now you are trying him again, and it's not until the day of trial that you realize your information is wrong? I mean, how does that work if you're so on him, so to speak?
Well, and just for the record, this was Ms. O'Halloran's case. I did it with her. She subbed it for trial. I just did the trial with her. And so I wasn't so on top of this case. But you know, with the amount of caseload we have, it just happens sometimes. And with regard to the notice, if you looked at the criminal complaint, which is Appellant's Appendix 1, and you look at the original information, which is Appellant's Appendix 51 through 52, the language was, did willfully and lawfully and feloniously place or increase a bet after acquiring knowledge of the outcome of the game or other event which is the subject of the bet. To wit, blackjack at the El Cortez, and then it said to wit by adding $5 to his wager after the winning hand had been determined. So based upon the subsection and what the state was alleging, that factual to wit at the end after the winning hand had been determined, I think it was stock language, but it didn't apply in this case. And also, it increased the state's burden as to what needed to be shown, because we had the video, they had the video, a prelim was held, they knew what the state's position was, that he had seen he had a 20, had seen the dealer didn't have a blackjack, and at that point he had acquired knowledge of the game. And also, when we realized it was before openings had even occurred. I know the defense says that they, had planned their case for 2 years based upon that language. However, I would disagree, especially when you see throughout voir dire, openings and closing, they were arguing for jury nullification. And also, they did have a remedy at that point. If it was so different or something they could not have prepared for, they could have asked for a continuance as well. But generally, the case law says, inaccurate facts in the information do not prejudice the defendant so long as he's on notice of the state's theory of prosecution, which he was. It was in the criminal complaint, the information, it was presented at the preliminary hearing. So, and I think that is why that our law allows us to amend any time before verdict, as long as it's not a new or different charge, which it wasn't, and as long as the substantial rights of the defendant weren't prejudiced. And in this case, it wasn't. It was done even prior to opening statement. The cases that it was found that it was improper or prejudiced the defense, that was when the state tried to do it after the defense had presented their case or after the defendant had testified, basically, you know, cutting off their defense, cutting them at the knees. But in this case, it was well before opening statement, and there was a remedy if they weren't prepared. But I think when you look at the entire record as a whole, their defense was going to be jury nullification. So it didn't change with the amendment that we made solely to the factual basis, not to the type of crime that was alleged in the information or the criminal complaint. It was just the factual basis because it wasn't after the winning hand had been determined. I believe that's all my time unless the court has more questions.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Thomas.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. The first thing I would like to address is something that the state mentioned. The state mentioned that Mr. Manning got a huge benefit for the case that was overturned. Mr. Manning was only convicted of a burglary in Mr. Giacomo's first case with him because the state violated his constitutional rights. He spent 5 years in prison on that case, for which he will never get back. I would take great issue with the fact that Mr. Manning got a huge benefit in that situation. The second thing I would point out is that most of what the state argued in their rebuttal is all information that would have been great in a hearing, great for the court to have in a hearing about whether this was a vindictive prosecution or not. There was a lot of information the state mentioned that I'm just hearing today for the first time. For example, that perhaps this case was assigned to Ms. O'Halloran and then Mr. Giacomo joined it. The state mentioned that she may have spoken with the other prosecutor about why the case that Mr. Cochever had was dealt to a misdemeanor. We checked through the state's opposition to my motion to dismiss for vindictive prosecution, and the state speculates about why another prosecutor might have felt like this deserved a misdemeanor. The state didn't know, or at least if they knew, they didn't put it in their opposition. They were speculating that perhaps some cases are dealt to misdemeanors because witnesses don't show up or because of other reasons. So if it's true that there was witness problems and that's what resulted in the misdemeanor, we could have heard about it in a hearing. If it's true that Mr. Giacomo knew that, we could have heard about it in a hearing. All of the information presented today in front of the Supreme Court would have been great information for us to delve into in a hearing. And so I think at the very least, we would ask that this court remand the case back to district court to have a hearing. The third thing I'd like to address is the sentence that Mr. Manning received. I think that his sentence of life does shock the conscience. Because as a society, we're just starting to deal with and grapple with what justice really requires. The state said that they had the aim of protecting the community from Mr. Manning by placing him in prison for the rest of his life. Now, perhaps Mr. Manning should take responsibility for doing something, perhaps like stealing diapers and dog food or adding $5 to his bet. But do we as a society take away his freedom, the very essence of his life, for the rest of his life, to protect the community from possibly losing $5 or diapers and dog food? That's what shocks the conscience about a life sentence for a case like this. That's what shocks the conscience about a life sentence for someone who has committed petty thefts or thefts for 30 years. So I would argue that that was an abuse of discretion.
Well, what do you say to Mr. Giacomo's argument, though, that There are some defendants, even though their crimes individually are, I'll call it petty, but minor, but collectively are a repeat abuse of the public safety. Isn't the habitual criminal statute intended to address the behavior of those individuals and ultimately say enough is enough? If you're a habitual thief, we're going to put you in prison. You're the kind of person who should be there.
Perhaps that is correct, Your Honor. I still think it's an abuse of discretion in a situation like this for the court to give a life sentence to someone like Mr. Manning. And I would also argue that, again, as society is learning more about justice and crime and punishment, we are coming up with tools that could help prevent someone from continuously committing crime.
Ms. Holliday, I have a separate question on it. I'd like to return to the amended information
yes, Your Honor.
Issue that started your argument. In looking at the pleadings, what defense were you not aware of, or what allegation in the amended information were you not prepared to defend that you didn't have notice of?
So I see my time is up, if I may answer the court's question.
Yeah, I'm presiding, so you can
He's
answer.
The boss.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Well, like I said, the allegation that we entered the trial with was that the winning hand had been determined. And that was just plain false. That there's no way the state could prove that. The winning hand hadn't been determined. So then when the state switched the information to be that he increased his bet after acquiring knowledge of the outcome of the game or another event which is the subject of the bet. Now that's all confusing, first of all. I mean, I think we could probably argue for another 30 minutes about the statutory interpretation of what all that means. And you can see from our briefs that we're still arguing that mm-hmm. Mr. Manning didn't violate that statute. But at the very least, what is the subject of the bet?
Perhaps. So I was trying to hone in on what was included in the amendment that presented the issue. And so part of it was the interpretation of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
As embodied in the amendment. And whether that would provide a basis for the crime in the first place.
Yes, Your Honor. So statutory interpretation. Yeah. I mean, that could have been something that perhaps we had researched. Perhaps we would have wanted to get an expert to help us understand that statute. What is the subject of the bet?
So was any of this articulated to the judge when the amendment was permitted?
No, Your Honor. We were...
Did you articulate the problems you perceived happening, or did your... Did the defense do that at the time the amendment was entered?
No, Your Honor. When this came up, we were completely blindsided. You could see from the record that we needed a couple of minutes to even talk about how to proceed. I mean, hindsight is 20/20, and now I can see all the ways in which I would have attacked this new language.
Yeah.
But back then, you know, we would have...
You objected generally?
Yes, absolutely. We objected. We said we weren't prepared.
But not outlining some of the issues you've just stated.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions for Ms. Holliday? All right. Thank you, counsel, for your briefing and your argument.